Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
This week is a particularly busy week. We've got the World Bank and International Monetary Fund spring meetings and so much more that goes around and alongside those meetings. I'm joined by two guests today, Advas Aldinger. Hi, Advas.
Hi, Raj.
Great to hear your voice. I'm eager to hear what you have to say as you've been out there covering a lot of this week's events. And we've got a special guest in Ani Dasgupta. Hey, Ani.
Hey, Raj. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And you are, of course, the president and CEO of WRI. You know, people know your name around so much that goes on related to climate finance. So I'm eager to hear your take, too. Maybe I can just start with you because it seems like, you know, the big story this week, we're 10 months in to Ajay Banga's term as World Bank president, this kind of surprising pick by the Biden administration, who has set off a major historic reform at an institution you once worked at. How do you think that's going? What did you hear this week that kind of gives you a sense of how it's going? And in particular, on the issues you're focused on around climate.
So I think after Ajay's come in the last 10 months, and you guys have covered it very well, actually, what has happened. The big thing that happened is, you know, the bank has been resistant to the idea of climate as a development problem. That bridge was crossed. Now the World Bank has acknowledged climate and development together. They've done a lot of things to figure out how, what does it mean for the core business. I think for the meeting right now, the issue is the discussion Ajay Banga and others are having is how do you actually think about the finance system for the climate emergency that's in front of us and what should MDBs do about it? So it's not just the bank, I think it's MDB. So for example, just last month, the World Bank promised in 2018 after the Paris Agreement that all their funding will be aligned with climate. It took them 6 years, but last month this is what they've done. They've increased the core of climate finance to 45%. All those basic steps are there, Raj. And I think the discussion now would be about how do you use the bank resources, not only to increase the amount of resources, there'll be a lot of discussion, what does the bank need to do for the IDA replenishment, which Ajay has asked for, President Banga has asked for 25% more, or the IBRD replenishment. But the question would be actually, how is the bank planning to use whatever resources they have to leverage a higher amount of other capital outside the bank in private capital?
But, you know, I mean, I think IDA replenishment is a really big theme this year. There's a lot of discussion about it. It is a different IDA replenishment than we've seen in the past. Traditionally, IDA replenishment has often been more of a negotiation between IDA country representatives. And this year, it's much more high profile. And I think that's because of the environment that we're in. We've seen a lot of research released this week about the situation that the world's poorest countries, the countries that IDA works in, are facing. In many cases, these countries are spending more on debt than is coming in terms of aid or investment. And they're being forced to make really difficult trade-offs between paying debt and, you know, paying, you know, funding really important services like health and education. And so, you know, obviously in that environment, people are talking about the need for IDA being that much more important. And, you know, as Ani said, Ajay Banga has called for the biggest IDA replenishment ever. Where the reality hits the road is that you also see the donor countries in really constrained environments at home, and a lot of them are undergoing big elections this year. And so it is going to be harder to get that commitment. So I think it's a really dynamic and interesting conversation. I think, you know, IDA borrowing countries also want to have more of a say in what IDA looks like. So I think that's been a big theme that we've looked at. You know, one of the big announcements that we actually saw yesterday, and I'd be curious what Ani makes of this, was a commitment from the World Bank to provide 250 million people in Africa with energy access by 2030. And the African Development Bank said, we're going to partner with you and bring another 50 million people access to energy. And I think some of the details are not fully in there. But Ani, I'd be curious your thoughts about that announcement and what how that could sort of be operationalized.
I think for me, that was a welcome announcement to focus. Two ways it was good to focus on Africa and the sub-Saharan Africa that the announcement was. And also, we want more MDBs to be working together, because this coordinated approach among MDBs is something every country is asking for. So as you just said, that we don't know the details of how it will operationalize, but those two facets of it are actually very important to focus on country specificity. African Development Bank actually has a lot more knowledge on these countries. The bank is present. So this way, how will it operationalize? I think what I hear from countries always is clarity of access, you know, ease of access, and how much will be concessional. And those things will come up over and over again in this discussion. One thing we haven't talked about, Raj, which comes up with the IDA discussion very much, is indebtedness, which came up from the Bridgetown agenda, which is now everyone's talking about, is a critical factor in this discussion, the amount of concessional finance that might be part of the package.
Yeah, exactly. And there's obviously part of the Bridgetown agenda, you know, coming from Bridgetown, Barbados, is this idea that the concessional financing maybe needs to extend beyond just the poorest countries, but also to climate vulnerable countries, which, you know, would be a pretty big departure from the way the World Bank typically works. And that's also part of the zeitgeist, the debate that I'm hearing a lot about this week. I don't know about you, Ani.
I think that is a kind of a fundamental shift. How that is part of the agenda this time, and that's something we've been advocating, that if just the income is the only criteria for engagement on concessional finance, climate vulnerability should be another one. You take an example of any of the small island states that are middle-income countries by definition of per capita income, but they're also more climate vulnerable. So how do you bring these two perspectives together, which is exactly, Raj, the current discussion? We are very supportive of it, that these two kind of axes are being discussed so that vulnerability is actually discussed and part of the question. We have shown over and over, Raj, that, you know, climate change is everywhere. It's in every country. But people who suffer are the poor people in those countries and the poorer countries. So poor people in every country suffer. And that is the angle we people are trying to add, in addition to vulnerable poorer countries. So it's not saying either or. It's just how do you actually add a different dimension to this criteria. I think this is a very important shift. I think if it does happen, other MDBs will take on this on, and that will actually mainstream climate finance much more to all finance, which is where I think WRI is. WRI very much would like people to think about finance and how do we finance this transition? How do we protect societies and economies from climate disaster rather than the narrow angle of climate finance?
You know, there's one other thing I'd love to get your take on, Ani, which is, you know, we've mentioned, you brought up this idea of the MDBs collaborating, right? It's not just about the World Bank. It's about how do you create a platform that all the MDBs can work together. But there's also a question of collaborating within the World Bank group. And there's been a long history, right, of people talking about one World Bank group. And, you know, you were there for many years at the bank. You know it well. One of the reforms Ajay Banga has made is to take 20 countries and to have what they're calling joint representation, right? So there's just one country manager that represents the entirety of the World Bank group. I'd love your take on how big of a deal is this? How much does this actually matter?
First of all, Raj, your first point that the World Bank group comes together, not just the three or four organizations that are under the World Bank group umbrella, but different sectors inside the World Bank, which is the IBRD part of the world group, comes together. So this has been a discussion for a long time, as you very well know. The biggest reform that took place was after Wolfensohn's time, when we created this country directors who kind of owned that country relationship. This is just the IBRD part first. And that actually made a big difference, I thought, that the relationship was directly, everything went through the country director. And actually, there were much higher level of coordination across sectors after the reform. Then again, this person was supposed to represent the bank group then. How effective that was, you know, people can question it. So answer to your question directly, it's a good reform. It'll all matter how it is executed. And these 20 countries together are my own experiences. What will matter to get impact is country specificity. And the World Bank has a lot of people, correctly so, that actually understand the country and work with and have relationship. And those things will matter. So the country teams will still matter a lot to get actual outcome on the ground. But so what I'm saying is this is not a new direction. This is a very good direction, much needed. But how it'll be executed, we will see. Because just the last thing I want to say, you know, you've heard, you'll hear a lot, you'll heard a lot this spring meeting about guarantees and what role MIGA is saying. People are welcoming that all the guarantees have been consolidated. You know, we want to see much more of guarantees and all the instrument discussion in one discussion. If you have to finance X, how can all the instrument come together and finance it for you, and how you can get private capital into the discussion, right? That is the direction of travel. So this initiative actually helps us go towards that direction.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Editor at DevEx. If you are listening to this podcast, you're likely working to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. But are you subscribed to DevEx Newswire? Global development can be a fast-moving, complex sector. Our team of global reporters work every day to bring you the news you need to make sense of it all. In DevEx Newswire, we keep you up to date on issues ranging from climate change financing to gender equality and global health to transforming the food system, all in a fun-to-read, free newsletter delivered directly to you 5 days a week. Join the hundreds of thousands of global development professionals who receive DevEx Newswire and visit devx.com/newsletters to sign up to this free newsletter today.
I'm actually taking this podcast from a dressing room here at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C., just across town from the World Bank and where the spring meetings are happening. We're hosting with MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth, the Global Inclusive Growth Summit. And so it's filled with private sector players, investors, venture capitalists, social entrepreneurs, et cetera. And a lot of them are really excited by and interested in the World Bank's reform for exactly the reasons you just said, Ani, the sense that, you know, it is actually not just about what can the World Bank do on its own, but how does it crowd in this much broader ecosystem of players. I think there are people who are excited by this, but there's also people we're hearing from, and I know some of our reporting has shown, who feel like it's all going too slowly. What are you hearing in general? What has some of our reporting shown in terms of how the broader development community is feeling about what this spring meetings is turning out to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing to note is that the bank has sort of scaled down the official meetings, right? And you actually feel that, I think, in covering them. It's a little bit more understated this year, I think, than it has been in the past sometimes. But I think on this issue of reform, I think there are some people who do think it's not been yet bold enough or moved quickly enough. I think there is some skepticism that the proposals have been too vague, and so it's unclear exactly how they'll be implemented or what the impact will be. And I think, you know, I mean, there's the energy access announcement yesterday is an example. The World Bank, like, just now has made an announcement that it's going to, you know, deliver quality, affordable health services to 1.5 billion people by 2030. And so I think a lot of the questions are really about how are these things implemented? And okay, is the World Bank, you know, sort of tinkering around the edges and making changes and trying to keep shareholders happy by doing some of this capital adequacy work to get more out of the bank? But what is sort of the big vision? Where is the bank going? And I think, you know, on IDA specifically, one thing I've heard from people is that they really want to see the bank articulate a vision. It's not just that, you know, yes, these countries have need and IDA should be bigger than ever, but what will that money achieve? Give us the case for that, right? So I think that's where we're seeing some questions emerge. I did want to touch on one point that Ani brought up about sort of climate vulnerable countries. And we have seen some proposals in the MDB reforms, including in a recently released paper that's full of a whole bunch of proposals of what the bank plans to do. But within that, there are a couple proposed funds that would offer concessional capital to middle-income countries, to IBRD borrowers, to incentivize borrowing for global public goods like climate. So I think we are starting to see, you know, a little bit of how that sort of concessionality could work within more middle-income countries. I think also, you know, I think then sometimes you hear from low-income countries that, you know, are there then trade-offs? If there's limited pools of, you know, concessional capital, where should it go? And so I think that will be a dynamic debate moving forward. And I'll pitch it back to you, but I'm happy to talk more about the sort of private capital mobilization piece, because I've been focused a lot on that as well this week.
I think Adva's absolutely right. I mean, there is, like, where are we going? Like, what's the big idea? And if I may, if you indulge me, at least share a couple of big ideas that are out there. I am advocates of them. I'm not the only one. That we haven't seen this visioning. Let me just throw them out to you, if you see what I mean. So the two big ideas are the following. One is, it's clear that the amount of money that's required for the world to move to where we need to go, it's at 2.5, you can count it, whichever report you read, it's at a few trillion dollars a year, right? That's where we are. That's what people think, where what needs to happen. A lot of it's domestic, but a lot of it's private. Some of it is World Bank. Even if World Bank increases IDA and doubles is IBRD, it'll be still at some $150 billion compared to 2.5 trillion or whatever the number is. So the question is, how do you get to that number, right? And World Bank, my argument always be the World Bank's money, if you see the spectrum of different kinds of money, is the most thoughtful money in the world. It is concessional at some point. IDA is very concessional, but it has 22,000 people thinking about how to spend it. It has the most thoughtful capital in the world that can be used in the most catalytic way compared to all the other capitals there are, including domestic capital, because domestic capital don't have 20,000 people sitting behind it like the bank has. So the question is, how should that be used? So the big idea is that it should be used any which way, every dollar of it, to leverage the next $1 trillion that needs to be leveraged. So that is not at tinkering, not at MIGA doing $70 million or whatever it is that has done over the last 25 years. But you know, that is the mission, that is to leverage, co-finance, invest, figure out how you actually build a portfolio. So that is something you would change the bank. You wouldn't do project finance. You would do it differently.
That's a big idea in part because, well, you're right, there's 22,000 people who are thoughtful. Those might not be the right people to do that kind of work, right? Talking about a very different way the bank would function, a very different business model.
It is, but if you think about there are arrays of capital in the world, right? This is a capital countries have come together to put to say, how do we actually help countries develop in a path? Right now, the development challenge the world faces, how do we grow? I repeat, how do we grow in a way that doesn't actually make us more vulnerable to climate change? And how do we protect our population from what's already happening with climate change? That is the development challenge. So it's not about not growing. The question is, how do we help that happen? I personally think it's absolutely squarely in banks' mandate. The question is how to do it. And you're right, Raj, it might need different people, but that is a different problem than setting a mission of what we need to do, rather than saying, okay, these are the tools we have, what can we do with these tools, right? I'm just saying, what is it, if you just look at the big picture, what should an institution like bank do, given what we know today and given the challenges we face? I also think the thoughtful part of the capital, there's another very important thing the bank, I hope, does, should do, and is very capable of doing. But I don't hear much about it. I would love to hear what you think. I think too much of the discussion in the spring meeting and for the last 8 months has been very much about volume of money, which is important. I think the volume of money is absolutely important. All the reports that has been, it's about how do we get to a higher number of dollars. But I absolutely feel that this, what we're facing right now, is as actually economic transition of these countries to a different kind of economy that is low carbon, produces energy differently, moves people around differently, does agriculture differently, protects its economy from climate vulnerability. This is a different kind of economy that's not only just lower carbon, it's actually good for people and good for nature. This economic transition is the core heart of what we need to do, which includes many things, including policy changes. This is where the World Bank is good at, helping countries think through and support them on the economic transition so that they can attract more capital, so that... And I don't hear enough about the policy things that bank is not doing.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, if we're talking about private capital mobilization. One place where the bank can play a unique role is exactly on that policy environment, right? They're working closely with government. So figuring out, because yes, they should use their finance in ways that are catalytic, and I can get to that in a second. But this policy tool is incredibly important because while capital is a constraint, certainly in some of these environments, and you may need de-risking instruments, but the bank's information, if it's shared in a granular, usable way, can one, help to diminish some of the gap between the perceived and the real risks in these markets. And two, they can really use their knowledge and policy advice to help governments create a policy environment and the sort of stability and regulatory certainty that the private sector will demand to come in. So one of the things I want to talk about, so obviously Ajay Banga convened this private sector investment lab to basically get private sector ideas of what to do. The guarantee thing is interesting, but like you say, reforming MIGA, streamlining it's important. It's an important tool to scale because the private sector wants it. It's relatively low cost for the World Bank. It's proven to be effective, but it needs to be more than that. And I do think the model needs to shift and the risk appetite needs to shift. I think the challenge you run into, and a lot of this I think will have to happen at IFC, right? The World Bank's private sector arm. The challenge you run into is the culture itself is somewhat risk averse and the incentives are not aligned with this sort of new vision that you're putting out there. The incentives are very much aligned with let's get more money, more projects out the door, and not with how can we mobilize. Now, IFC is thinking about this. They've said that this year they're going to put out, their first sort of securitization instrument, and that's obviously a very finance world word. But essentially what it means is they're going to package some of their investments and sell them off to the private sector. And I think that originate-to-share model is something that they're going to be experimenting with, right? How can the IFC use its capital, sort of coming in, helping to do the project preparation, helping to take the initial risk, which is often, a greater risk, construction risk, et cetera, on big projects. And then down the road, private sector investors may be willing to take operational risk for an infrastructure project. They just don't want the construction risk, for example. So I think there are opportunities for the IFC to then sell off part of its investments in certain projects and then use that money to invest more, right? So it is also kind of a volume play because they'll have more money if they're selling it off. It will allow them to do more, but it is about thinking differently. And I think it will be very hard to make those changes, right? I think at least from what I'm hearing from people, I don't know that this idea to wholesale change the model has really, been pushed forward. And I think where you are seeing the model sort of fully embraced and going, full steam ahead is actually the Inter-American Development Bank and IDB Invest, its private sector arm. They just got a replenishment. They agreed on a new strategy, which is centered around this model of originate to share. And how do we, leverage our money, put in a small amount of money and get 10 times that amount of money from the private sector on a deal from the start, right? Or sell off parts of the investment down the road. And it's been really interesting because obviously the focus this week is on the World Bank and the IMF, but I have heard an awful lot about IDB from the private sector, from public sector. And I think a lot of people will be watching what happens at IDB Invest, including shareholders. I actually heard a U.S. Treasury official say this today. If the model works at IDB Invest, this sort of originate to share, the U.S. and other shareholders may start to look to other multilateral development banks and say, you need to do this too.
Yeah, Ani, I mean, the World Bank is obviously the 800-pound gorilla, but they're not the only game in town. And maybe there's a competition for who can reform and modernize and innovate. How do you see that? I mean, as a former World Banker, I hear a lot of people say the World Bank has to be the one to lead on these issues. Is that right?
First of all, there should be competition and a healthy competition because there's no one way to do this. And we are in a crisis right now. We should reform and figure out. And what Advas just said about Inter-American Development Bank is absolutely right. I must say they are a little ahead of the game because they started with earnest, I think. They didn't have years of kind of dodging the issue that the bank unfortunately faced, which actually set it back, right? It's not It wasn't doing all the things IDB's doing. The competition is good, I think. I do think the World Bank needs to lead, at least not lead, be an equal player. I do think that the world needs the MDBs to work much more together, much more collaboratively, and we have seen instances of that. If your question was, does the bank have to lead in everything? I don't think so. If IDB has figured something out that leverages private capital, the World Bank should learn. It is not historically hasn't done these things, but the new bank should learn and incorporate. The bank has some advantages that other organizations don't have that should be leveraged, especially in the policy space and especially being a global organization. But we see, for example, the announcement of Adesina was a good one in Africa to say, you know, we'll collaborate. It's a relatively modest size compared to what the world needs, but at least it's a start. So, I don't think the World Bank has to be the leader in everything, but I do think the World Bank has a huge responsibility at this moment where the world needs a different economy. This is the bread and butter for the World Bank. I say it also, as you noted, Raj, being at the bank for quite a few years, and I know from inside what are people who work there good at.
One of the other things that I'm sort of looking at this week is also around the measurement of mobilization, right? Because I think there are a lot of different conversations around mobilization. And you know, the bank can also talk about the mobilization of its paid-in capital, right? Which it does do, right? That's a different form of private capital mobilization. It's not bringing in private capital on a deal, but it is issuing bonds and then using that money to lend to countries, right? So how you define private capital mobilization and then measure it and then share that data, I think is going to be really important. Publish What You Fund has released a really interesting paper that proposes sort of a new methodology for how MDBs can measure and report on private capital mobilization. And I think one thing that's important to remember in this discussion is that private capital mobilization is going to look different in different countries, right? So I think when you look at pushing the bank to do more, you know, leveraging and more of this type of work and more private capital mobilization, that mobilization ratio in upper middle income countries and middle income countries, it probably could and should be a lot higher than it is today. But in low income fragile countries, where it's just really hard to get private sector in, it's going to be harder to do it in those markets. And that's maybe then where the World Bank and the IFC focuses its own balance sheets, right? If private sector isn't going to go there. And then in, you know, the middle income, upper middle income countries, it can do more of this originate to share, more of this crowding in at the start, and just structuring deals differently in those markets, right? So I think there needs to be a nuanced conversation, right? Because you don't want to set a new target around these issues and then have it have certain unintended consequences.
And I thought I'd just bring up a couple of other perspectives that I'm hearing a lot here at the Global Inclusive Growth Summit, because there's a lot of foundations here, a lot of people from the philanthropy world, a lot of social entrepreneurs that get philanthropy money. And there's a big conversation about how the philanthropy space has to really shift to enable what the banks are trying to do, because you need philanthropic capital to take some of that really early risk, to provide some technical assistance, to, you know, get an entrepreneur from the ground up to be able to get started to the point where some of these new capital flows coming from the MDBs can actually matter. So there's a bit of a call here for philanthropy to be a part of this broader ecosystem and be more risk-taking than they are right now, and to not just kind of go off and do their own thing. So that's one thing I'm hearing. And the other, there's a lot of insurance companies, there's a lot of investment bank executives that are here in Washington for the spring meetings and for this Global Inclusive Growth Summit. And what apparently there's a lot of meetings happening in the background, bilaterals and some closed door sessions. And they're saying that, look, we actually need policy change, as Ani mentioned, but not just in the developing countries. We need policy change in terms of what banks and insurance companies are allowed to do from places like the US and Europe in order to be allowed to invest some of their capital in emerging markets. Not enough attention has been paid to the regulatory environment that is in some ways forcing Western capital to be so risk averse that they're avoiding the kinds of investments that would be required for the World Bank to do things like originate and share.
I think that's absolutely true. I hear that certainly from the private sector that, you know, the Basel III regulations in the wake of the economic crisis have really, really constrained what banks can do. And that has also had an impact on some development finance institutions, which have to follow banking regulations. That's obviously a big picture conversation. How do you change some of those rules? But it would most certainly make an impact. I think the other place where a lot of people talk about change is with credit rating agencies. And so how can MDBs work with credit rating agencies maybe change, tweak risk models, both so MDBs maybe could lend more of their existing money, but also really looking at the implications of that in emerging market and developing economies.
Both things you said resonate a lot with me. On the philanthropic capital, we are seeing, for example, GAP, the fund that Beth Rockefeller and IKEA set up for energy transition, works with World Bank in the examples of South Africa and the government. So we are seeing that kind of, you know, working together part, you know, aligning part of that. Not enough yet, because a lot of the philanthropic capital are aligned to specific program goals, but this alignment, I think there's openness and understanding on philanthropic capital that something different needs to happen, some different collaboration. But to build on, and I love the point you made about the supply side of regulation, not just demand side of what's happening in the country that's receiving the money, the countries that are sending the money. The thing that is actually very much in the air in these last few days is how much money is actually flowing out of poor countries to richer countries for different reasons. And the number I just heard yesterday was $68 billion of outflow of debt payments, other payments, investments, whatever they are. We need to think about a finance system that has private capital, public capital, the regulators, and the banks of the world. So how can this work together to actually provide the capital that is needed? Otherwise, we will never get to this $2.5 or $3 trillion we're talking about. So the both points you made, Raj, are about how do the different systems, different parts of the system work together. I'm hoping that in Baku this year, which is a finance discussion, that we talk about how does the financial system that exists today actually is helping or not helping our transition. I don't think it's helping right now. And rather than just fixate another number like $100 billion and just negotiate that. So I hope we get to this next level of discussion. How can the financial architecture, which is what, you know, if you look at the Mia Motley and the Bridgetown agenda, that's how it started. Like, this system is not serving us.
But I think, Ani, we're going to need a new politics around this, because right now, the idea that you would go to Western publics and say, let's actually deregulate the big banks and let's think about using taxpayer money to, in a way, subsidize, you know, to reduce the risks for their investments in emerging markets, right, or frontier markets, that probably doesn't sell very well in Brussels or in London or here, right here in Washington, D.C. And I think within the spring meetings participants, that might be an emerging consensus. But for this to be a reality, we're going to need a new political conversation. And I think a much closer connection to questions of national security, which are maybe the only questions that could potentially trump the current desire not to deregulate and not to see taxpayer money supporting these kinds of guarantees. And so I think what's challenging here is the World Bank has to lead the MDBs. It has to reform itself internally, and it needs to be a leader in the global north in changing the politics, because that's probably the only way you get to the scale of reforms that are going to be needed. How do you feel about that, Ani?
Raj, you're absolutely right. The politics of the north is very much at play. I mean, you just see right now what's happening in Europe on agricultural policy. And what we have seen, and this is published data, that actually the from the G7++ countries, the richer countries that are the donor community, the financing for what used to be the ODA, the overseas development, is getting squeezed by the Ukraine war, immigration issues, domestic issues that they had to face. So the ODA money is actually, if you look at the ODA over the last few years, the concessional part has gone down. So what I'm saying is the politics of the richer countries are difficult to increase ODA. So at the same time, every number shows that we need actually more concessional financing to get any of these things done. So in this backdrop, Raj, don't you think there is an opportunity for this rich country to say, okay, we don't actually have a lot more capital, but could we do a regulatory tweak that encourage our banks or our investors to actually, and we will count it if they went to a country in Global South that doesn't have energy investment, actually went and took that risk and did the energy investment, we will give them some credit. Don't you think there's a space there? And I'm speculating here, of the politics being in favor rather than opposing that.
You know, I think you're right. I mean, certainly it has to be tried, and until it is really tested, we won't know. But what's interesting is in many ways, it's the same constituents. I think maybe even down to the same members of Congress here in the US at least, who would be opposing any financial deregulation, but would also prioritize climate action. So it's really the same people. And so I think it's absolutely a fight that has to be had, and it has to be elevated, because right now, and this is not something just coming from me, this is something I've heard from others this week who are in this space, who come from the finance world, from banks, from insurance companies, from private equity. They say, like, we've been talking about this for a while, but we're talking about it kind of at our level, and it needs to be elevated in the political conversation. Otherwise, we're not going to get anywhere. So I think that's at least one takeaway for me from these spring meetings. And as we, you know, look to wrapping up our conversation, there's so much more we could talk about. But at least for me, one bottom line that I'll throw out, and then I'd love both of your takes on it, is a sense of like what the narrative is this week. You know, what when we talk about this, when we look back on this first spring meetings of Ajay Banga's term, will we say, you know, this was the beginning of a successful reform? Or will the critics who are out there saying, gosh, it's not moving fast enough, will they turn out to be right? That sort of there's that inertia is too hard to change. The bank culture is too hard to change. And I guess for me, one of the interesting conversation points I've had with many people this week is what counts as a small change? And maybe the things Ajay Banga is doing, changing the corporate scorecard or having joint representation in certain countries, that sounds sort of small and iterative, that maybe those are actually exactly the kind of management changes you need that will lead to much bigger impact down the road. And that, I think, is a bit of the debate that I'm picking up on this week. What's your thought on that, Ani and Ava, as we wrap up?
My thought is, I hope, I don't know actually what the tone will be end of this, because they're end of this week, meaning Monday, what are we going to talk about? I hope the tone is that a reform has started and it's the beginning of it, and we need to see much more. So there's a positive momentum. All of us need it. I would like it. I don't think there's enough happened yet, Raj, to talk about culture change in the bank. I don't see that yet. Enough difficult things have happened to actually answer the question, yes, the culture changes. I do see changes taking place. I think MIGA is one example. I've talked about it. I do see the engagement with the private sector, but we actually don't know that private sector thing. Besides the MIGA thing, how else will they work? So I think on the culture change, it's an interesting question, actually. It's too early to say yes or no, or I don't see it yet. I do hope there is a positive momentum. And I think the small changes that you mentioned are small changes. That's my perspective. I think the big changes will only come with a bigger vision, I think, but I don't know. So I'm not ready. I would love to hear, Adwi, because Adwi's been around much more meetings, that what the tone of the outcome is.
I actually also agree that I think it's like too early to pass judgment on the changes. And I mean, if you look at the list of proposals, it's a really long list of proposals. And so maybe a lot of small changes do add up to something bigger. I think that is a question. I think one of the reasons that there's still sort of questions out there is that we don't have a lot of details on the implementation of a lot of these things. And some of these proposed changes, the new scorecard, while that might end up being a really important thing and sort of refocus the bank around outcomes and impact, the bank has changed its scorecard before, right? So some of these changes are not necessarily like, you know, I mean, they're new in this context, they're new in some of the details, but I do think that I would agree that I think it's kind of too early to know exactly what the future will hold. I don't sort of get the sense. I think people are like, you know, I don't think there's like an overwhelming air of pessimism, right? But I think there's still some uncertainty, maybe some hopefulness that things will change. But I do think, you know, while these small changes might be important, do they actually transform the organization? I think is a question that's still an open one.
I don't think I have not heard pessimism. It's a good point you make. I think there is hopefulness. And I just want to say from where I sit and what the work I do, I absolutely want the bank to reform and succeed. We need the bank to lead and succeed. And I, at least from my side, it'll get all the support, all the help to succeed. I think it still remains a very important organization for the transformation the world needs.
Yeah, I think it's more and more central, which is one reason these spring meetings and this week in DC is going to become a bigger and bigger thing. I mean, I mentioned the side events that we're hosting, but there's so many others beyond what we're doing here at DevEx. And it's just become a place where I think all the various sectors, public and private and social entrepreneurs and NGOs, they all say, like, we've got to be in Washington this week because the World Bank and, frankly, the IMF, which we haven't talked to about as much today, but because both of these institutions are more and more central to the ability to solve the big global challenges like climate, like migration, like the humanitarian crises facing the world. So I'm really, this is a space that we will not just watch, we will be on top of it and we'll continue to be and look out for lots more coverage right from here at the Global Inclusive Growth Summit, but from all of our reporters, including Abba, who are out there covering as much as we can this week.
I wanted to just make one quick pitch for listeners, which is that we are doing a special edition series of podcast episodes specifically around the World Bank spring meeting. So really an opportunity to dive deeper on World Bank reform, on IDA replenishment, on private capital mobilization, a lot of the issues we've talked about today, and sort of getting people's perspectives on the takeaways. So it's in the same feed as this podcast. So just want to encourage people to tune in to those episodes as well, which will give you an opportunity to get a sort of deeper dive on some of these issues.
I will definitely be listening. I am looking forward to nerding out on some of this. a lot of these details really, really matter. I mean, they're hugely consequential, and just getting to hear from you and other experts is such a delight. Thank you, Ani. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. Yeah.
Thank you.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.